A mighty Cowrie has fallen. Hugh Winder Nibley, 1910-2005. Lewis Midgley. He will be reading this essay. Even though what I offer is a personal remembrance, I hope that what I have to say will in some measure speak both for and to others whose lives have or should have been influenced by him. Obviously, others have their own stories of how and why they came to know or know of Nibley, and hence how they were influenced by his example and scholarship. Even though they may never have known him directly, many came to appreciate him through what he wrote, the talks he gave, or the classes he taught. It may be that some who did not know him personally will discover that, without even being aware of what was happening, they were influenced by Hugh Nibley. I have discovered that each person who knew him, even through his talks or writings, found or fashioned a different persona, one often suited to his or own biases, needs, or longings. My reflections will be personal, intensely personal. I do not, however, want what I write to be platitudinous and generic, such as might end up in a letter of recommendation for a student one hardly remembers. And I will strive to avoid, as Hugh would perhaps say, borrowing some slurpy lines from the writer's dreary handbook of sentiments and cliches. In 1949, some political scientists at the University of Utah invited Hugh to read a paper on ancient statecraft. That essay could be described as an account of the political dynamics of ancient nomadic and sedentary peoples and their related religious symbols, rituals, and ideology. When his address was announced, I was intrigued. I was, as I will explain, looking for light. Here was someone I had never previously encountered, someone housed at Brigham Young University in religious education, but apparently working in ancient history, who would be lecturing Gentiles as well as Latter-day Saints on ancient politics and religion. From that moment on, he had a profound and lasting impact on me. On that occasion, there opened for me two new and exciting worlds. One of these involved nomadic hunters in antiquity who were intent on conquering sedentary farmers and thereby setting up sometimes vast empires. The other world that came into view that evening was much less remote and, for me, more lasting. That first encounter with Hugh Nibley changed my life. On that fateful evening, I was delighted to discover an obviously bright, impish, loyal Latter-day Saint with something new and interesting to say. He was also not a bit shy about his faith, which was not the case with most others back then. Instead, he stood his ground, and I have always tried to follow his example. In addition, it was a delight to witness Hugh's relaxed, witty repartee with the learned. I discovered later that he enjoyed and perhaps even preferred conversations with skeptics and doubters, especially if they had thought seriously about what he later called the terrible questions. Or if they knew or cared about the past and were interested in a discussion consisting of more than mere sentiments and slogan thinking. It would not be an understatement to say that I was deeply impressed with his intelligence and the depth of his learning, as well as the fact that he made no effort to disguise his faith. He could play the academic game as well or even better than the most skeptical critic along the Wasatch Front. Though he was not a stereotypical saint, at that moment he became for me a role model. Now, over 5 decades later, it may be difficult to appreciate the profound impact Hugh had on young Latter-day Saints and even on some older ones. Most of those entering the university in those days were among the first or even the first to do so in their families. With little or no experience with universities, parents tended to fear that their children would be charmed into shedding their faith. These fears were not without foundation. Along the Wasatch Front, each university had its array of those eager to disabuse young Latter-day Saints of their parochial past as well as their presumably crude, primitive faith. This was in addition to their dominant culture of unbelief then found in universities. Hugh was able to, in various ways, to point a whole generation of young Latter-day Saints in a different direction, one that stressed both learning and fidelity to God. Hugh was certainly an eccentric with his own sometimes colorful idiosyncrasies. There was his hat. It was clearly part of his costume. It was visible in 1949 at that lecture on ancient statecraft. With it and with his Deseret Industries dudes, he signaled not only a disinterest in the ways of the of this world, but a distaste for its fads and fashions. It was only after my initial encounter with Hugh's secular scholarship that I started paying attention to his earlier efforts to explicate and defend the faith of the saints. I soon tracked down the series of essays he had published on baptism for the dead in ancient times, and then I located his first essay on the Book of Mormon. My passion for and enthrallment with his scholarship on the Book of Mormon, as well as my own fondness for that book, thus began before and continued through my first mission to New Zealand, 1950-1952. As a missionary, I was busy trying to introduce Maori saints to his scholarship. When I returned some 50 years later, there were still saints in New Zealand who could remember my spouting both about the Book of Mormon and Nibley. This fact did not at all displease me. From the moment in 1949, when I heard Hugh read that paper, I began collecting his essays. I am confident that others did this as well. I was conscientious, even compulsive. The result of my efforts over the years was the annotated, quote, bibliography and register published as a preface in the first volume of the Festschrift for Nibley. My lists served as a bibliographical foundation for subsequent volumes of the collected works of Hugh Nibley. It pleases me to have had this tiny role in that enormous project. I have discovered that for those enthralled to his writings, there were quite distinct Nibleys. Some, like me, have been drawn to his defense of the historical authenticity of the Book of Mormon, or to his speculation about institutions and practices in antiquity. Others have seen something liberating in his scathing social criticism and his fondness for the natural environment, or in his trenchant criticisms of the rationalizations we tend to provide for worldly ambition and endeavors. Still others have been attracted to his anti-war sentiments. If one is inclined to employ the mushy, imprecise language of journalists who are busy oversimplifying things, then these apparent anomalies can be reduced to a vulgar slogan. In this instance, almost any against my better judgment, I yield to this temptation, much like Reinhold Niebuhr, the famous American Protestant theologian and social critic, 1892-1971. Nibley turned to the right, became a religious conservative by passionately adopting and defending a Latter-day Saint orthodoxy or neo-orthodoxy, including the Book of Mormon and hence Joseph Smith's prophetic charisms, in contrast to a liberal cultural Mormonism prevalent after World War II among some nominally Latter-day Saint intellectuals. But again, somewhat like Niebuhr, Nibley also turned to the left and hence was liberal in his various political and social concerns. This fact was not always clear to either his friends or critics. When Hugh's political opinions became clear, it was disconcerting to some of his admirers, just as his persistent, passionate defense of the faith was troublesome to dissident and cultural Mormon saints, some of whom were inclined to agree with his social criticism. One especially delightful yet disconcerting aspect of Hugh's career flowed from his genuine passion for understanding an enormous range of questions about the past, present, and future. He had a great breadth of knowledge that rested on his remarkable mastery of a host of ancient and modern languages. This led some to claim that he was a mere dilettante, since he did not focus on any one topic or people or time period, nor was he enslaved by some narrow scholarly school. Other than a capacity born of his considerable erudition that made it possible for him to attempt comparisons over time and between cultures, he was not at all beholden to any one narrow scholarly methodology. Unlike many other high-powered academics who are often locked into their narrow specialties, beholden to a current popular academic method of dealing with issues, or who speak for some school of thought, no one could quite anticipate what new question, topic, approach, or literature Hugh would find interesting and consequently worthy of his efforts. There were some exceptions, a few of which are worth mentioning. Hugh quite properly always detested theology, much to my delight and to the consternation of a few of his readers. This can be seen in various ways. For example, in the series of radio addresses he gave on the regular Sunday evening program of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at 9 p.m., broadcast by KSL between March 7 and October 17, 1954. That series was entitled Time Vindicates the Prophets, and it was initially circulated as 31 separate pamphlets. The material was again published as The World and the Prophets, one of Hugh's most popular and significant books. In those talks, in addition to discounting what theologians had fashioned, Nibley sought to identify the predicament that some of them found themselves in with the heavens effectively shut. In addition, he also made an effort to sort out the troublesome relationship between pagan philosophy and Christian faith. He did not, however, see philosophy as the source of the apostasy, but merely as an element in what turns up when something has already gone drastically wrong. Hugh's disdain for theology, what might be called classical theism or the so-called traditional Christian worldview, elements of which he believed were borrowed from pagan philosophy, did not make him an enemy of rational discourse. He did not abjure intellectual effort, wide and deep learning, or genuine academic accomplishments, as even a glance at the form or the contents of his writings should indicate. He did, however, have harsh things to say about sloppy sentimentality or silly slogan thinking. He loathed sophistry. He also detested rhetoric, which he understood as the despicable art of selling what amounts to sentimental sweets to the sick, for a stipend, of course, when what they really need is a dose of real medicine, a turn or return to God, and hence also a turn away from the fads and fashions of this world. Though he had much more conversant with historians and literary figures, including poets, Hugh occasionally consulted writings on or about ancient philosophers. He drew upon this litter when he found it useful. He certainly did so in three lectures he gave in May 1963 at Yale University. These essays, as well as elsewhere, he described the old and still unresolved conflict between radically different efforts to understand the world, one longing for and perhaps willing to accept divine revelation, and another that depends exclusively on unaided human reason. He also identified a third mode, which he described as a sophistic junkyard, which garbles, muddles, and corrupts both the prophetic, mantic, and the philosophic, sophic ways of understanding the human situation. He was, I believe, unable to figure out where some philosophers fit into his own schema. The way he set out the opposition between what others have called the wisdom of Jerusalem and the wisdom of Athens is still remarkably insightful. When I encountered Hugh, much of what went on in university seemed to me stale and boring, mere textbook stuff. And yet it still ground away at the faith of young saints. Why? Then, as now, disciplined conformity rather than intellectual independence was the norm. Genuine learning, while celebrated, was still downplayed and replaced by received ideologies of the day. In addition, our teachers, if they were nominally Latter-day Saints, tended to be part of what has come to be known as, quote, the lost generation, end quote. That is, those first ones who ventured out into the glamorous world of universities and came back with degrees but without much, if any, faith, or with a studied skepticism about divine things. This was especially true of those who went into the humanities or social sciences. Some may have taken skepticism with them, but others clearly had their faith frayed by the profoundly secular instruction they received. Some saw this introduction as a liberation from the confining faith of a parochial community. But those who took this route did not seem to notice that they had merely moved from one religion to another. They neglected to see that their teachers were really preachers of a fashionably new faith from which God was excluded. 20 years after the end of World War II, Richard Bushman, commenting on what was still taking place, asked why, quote, "We have lost so many of our young people in Eastern schools or at the University of Utah, for that matter," end of quote. His answer was that, quote, they are overpowered by a secular culture that dazzles them with its splendors and seemingly puts Mormon parochialism in the shade. End of quotation. In addition, it must be remembered that even after World War II, the University of Utah was a center to the degree that there was such a thing of what should be called Latter-day Saint intellectual life. BYU had not yet emerged from obscurity. When I entered the university in 1948, there was little or no non-devotional, intellectually challenging Latter-day Saint literature. There was then essentially no genuinely professional Latter-day Saint history other than a few items such as rather pedantic Utah history texts. I found this disconcerting. There was virtually no literature that gave even a hint that the faith of the saints was intellectually viable. I needed or desired, as did other Latter-day Saints, some literature that at least offered a faint assurance that my faith could withstand the best that the culture of unbelief dominated universities at that time could offer. The Mormon History Association was launched nearly two decades after I entered the university. For me, the promise of a competent professional history of the Latter-day Saint past was attractive, even though I did not plan on contributing to it. I also very much liked the idea behind the founding of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. Later, I had to admit that both were mixed bags. From 1966 to the present, an internal struggle has taken place in both venues. There are, I grant, those who strive to tell the story of the Latter-day Saint past from within the categories of faith, but there are also those enthrall in one way or another to the corrosive secularizing influences that are more or less borrowed from or dependent upon the culture of unbelief that still dominates academic circles and the media and popular culture. I witnessed an early version of this struggle that took place at the University of Utah after 1952, and in various ways it involved Hugh Nibley. Coming immediately after my first mission in New Zealand, 1950-1952, this intellectual struggle was for me tantalizing, provocative, and challenging. I listened and observed. I sensed that it was wise to keep one's opinions to oneself, which I more or less did. Unlike some others who blasted away at the parochial saints and loved to berate the brethren, the best of the lot, Sterling McMurrin, 1914-1996, then teaching in philosophy but later in history, manifested a measure of moderation and was a model of civility. I eventually came to see that his neat and orderly sorting of the ideas and isms, while formidable on the surface and helpful for a preliminary understanding, also obscured the vast richness and complexity hidden away in the enormous literature of historical, theological, and philosophical speculation. His mode of doing intellectual history also tended to obscure the fact that it was itself part of and situated within a conversation in which the current dominant biases were inexorably being ground down and replaced. I also discovered that there is much more going on in both current and past conversations that is not accessible with labels, brand names, or appeals to one's own superior rationality. While I was working on a master's degree, Hugh brought to my attention Rudolf Bultmann, 1892 1976, a German New Testament scholar who was attempting to demythologize what he considered the primitive mythology he found in the New Testament. I proposed to McMurrin that I examine everything I could find by and about Bultmann, and that we meet each week to discuss what I had discovered. Though he was unfamiliar with Bultmann, McMurrin accepted my proposal. My encounter with Bultmann was enlightening and eventually led me to the writings of Martin Heidegger, 1889-1971. Since Bultmann seemed to have fallen under his spell. When I mentioned this to McMurrin, he labeled Bultmann a theistic existentialist and placed him in the same category as Paul Tillich. 1886-1965, then an influential German-American Protestant theologian. Reading Bultmann also led me to the literature on interpretation of text, that is, what is often called hermeneutics. I came to see that the way we tell stories about the past depends upon how we read texts. I discovered that how we read and hence understand or explain the meaning of what we find in texts, that we what we select in the text we consult or for which we search, and also what we will allow within what we consider the realm of reality, depend upon the assumptions and interpretations we bring to that task or somehow eventually adopt. The historian provides the plot, and so the story always necessarily has a political motivation and setting. I also began to see that the categories and distinctions we frequently take for granted have their own often convoluted history. From this point on, all talk about balanced, neutral, detached, disinterested, objective historians and their vaunted histories became for me problematic. I could see that the intellectual history with which I was being indoctrinated was itself dependent upon assumptions that were often poorly grounded, if not entirely groundless, or at least unexamined. I began to see that my teacher's background assumptions and beliefs also had their own precarious history. I was then able to see how and why bright, articulate people could understand and explain the same things differently, read texts differently, and hence also fashion quite different stories. They did so on the basis of different and conflicting categories and assumptions or beliefs, part of which they bring to the task at hand. It became clear to me that the historian provides the plot and selects what will count as evidence. Subsequently, I could begin to sort out exactly what divided Nibley from McMurrin. One who begins with the secular credo that angels cannot possibly make books available to human beings since there are no angels, will have no reason to even read the Book of Mormon. With an agnostic dogma in place, nothing will ever be allowed to count in favor of the Book of Mormon. It becomes obvious why one so disposed would insist that efforts to stress the importance of the Book of Mormon were signs of an irrational, quote, departure from the authentic spirit of Mormon religion, end quote. I came to see that Nibley's way of doing intellectual history was as superior to McMurrin's neat sorting of ideas and writers, which seemed formidable on the surface and was helpful for a preliminary understanding, but which obscured the enormous complexity, ambiguity, and richness hidden in a vast literature. In addition, I was troubled by the fact that the use of ontological categories seemed to compromise needlessly the links between the content and ground of faith and historical matters. In 1953, after having studied under Tillich for a year at Union Theological Seminary, McMurrin assigned his students a book by Tillich that was larded with talk about being itself, that is, the God of classical theism. In that book, Tillich flatly denied that God can properly be said to exist. He talked instead of a God somehow beyond the God of traditional Christian theology. For Tillich, God simply could not exist, since only finite things exist, and he conceived God as the unconditional, infinite, absolute ground or power of being in everything that exists. Finite existing things in Tillich's system are thus real only to the extent that they participate in their essence or nature. Existing things are merely actual, only to some degree real. They are real to the extent that they stand out of non-being by participating in being itself, which he thought constituted the power or ground of being in everything that exists, but which is not another existing thing alongside other things. Tillich insisted that this is where sophisticated theology had been heading since Christians started drawing upon pagan categories and explanations. All of this seemed to me to give priority to categories borrowed from pagan sources, none of which are found in the Bible. In 1963, while I was working at Brown University on my dissertation on Paul Tillich, Hugh delivered those three lectures at Yale. I was confident that I had collected everything Tillich had published, but I was wrong. Hugh had discovered something written by Tillich that I had missed, and he made some polemical use of what he had found. Nibley wrote, quote, "Protestants and Catholics alike would now have us believe that the old prophetic tradition was never completely lost. But Professor Tillich knows better. This discourse," he writes at the introduction to a recent study, "is based on the proposition that the prophetic tradition of the church was lost. It was one of the great tragedies of the history of the Christian church that this tradition actually and virtually completely perished. For St. Augustine, the millennium is here. Everything essential has been achieved in the hierarchy of the church. With this theory, the spirit of prophecy was expelled from the official church." End of quotation. I was surprised that Nibley had called this development, that Tillich had called this development a tragedy, since he was bent on taking it to its logical conclusion. The historical ground and content of faith is radically compromised when the prophetic gift is suppressed and theology takes the place of divine revelations. When one reduces God to being itself, the ground or power of being, what becomes of crucial matters like the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, or of Stephen's or Joseph Smith's theophanies? What happens to the account of the recovery of the Book of Mormon or the theophanies described in it, or the core of its prophetic message? Speculation about divine things moves away from the historical, the mundane, the concrete. My encounters with Nibley, then McMurrin, and eventually Paul Tillich, taught me that it is a grand mistake to turn the Christian story into theology, set out in abstract categories. My own efforts to defend the historical authenticity of the Book of Mormon, and hence also Joseph Smith's prophetic truth claims, flow directly from these early insights. McMurrin was fond of Paul Tillich and contemptuous of Hugh Nibley. C.S. Lewis, 1898-1963, and Karl Barth, 1886-1968, all of whom he dismissed as spouting sheer irrationalism. Why? Lewis clearly saw the necessity of Christian faith having historical contents and grounding. That is at least part of what has made him attractive to Latter-day Saints. Nibley's treatment of the Book of Mormon, while not aimed at proving it true, something he thought both unnecessary and impossible, began by accepting it for what it claims to be. And in his own way, something like this was also true for Barth. In the famous Criticism of Religion, which parallels and perhaps surpasses what can be found in the writings of Karl Marx, Barth argued that in religion, human beings did the talking. In divine revelation, though not necessarily in the scriptures, but always when guided by the Holy Spirit, it was God doing the talking, not just in previous times, but even now. Barth thus distinguished religion, which is a human manufacture, from divine revelation and the Word of God, which is not to be confused with or reduced to the Bible. Unlike at least some conservative Christians, Barth was not advancing a bibliolatry. McMurrin saw all this as irrational, not because it avoided bibliolatry, but because it did not focus on the words of human beings about divine and human things, that is, on theology, but rather on the Word of God, a witness of which is available here and now through the Holy Spirit. When Bultmann insisted that the Bible was larded with, among other things, quaint legends and bizarre myths, which he insisted must now be demythologized and thereby transformed into a message of some significance to German skeptics, Karl Barth was simply appalled by such audacity. Barth argued that, quote, "We need to take the literal seriousness of the message of the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ if we are to find ourselves in a new life, in a new world." If Rudolf Bultmann were surrounded by a church which in its preaching and order, in its politics and its relation to state and society, in its whole way of dealing with modern problems, were to put into practice even a little of its belief in the risen Lord, then not only would it be practically immune against the heresies of Bultmannian conclusions and theses, but it would also have a reply to Bultmann, the one argument which could perhaps cause him to abandon his basic position. With its tying of the gospel to a pagan ontology and make him free, a free expositor of the New Testament, freely speaking for itself. End of quotation. 70 years ago, as a young missionary in New Zealand, I was concerned to show the links between the faith of the saints and events in the past, and hence to defend the prophetic message and gift, as well as the historical authenticity of the Book of Mormon. In this, I have followed Nibley and not McMurrin. When I first arrived at BYU, I doubted that any Latter-day Saint would be tempted to attempt to sever the link between faith and history by tying the, quote, the gospel to a pagan ontology, end of quote, to use Karl Barth's pithy formulation. I was naive. I had no idea what would eventually be promulgated by signature books, preached at Sunstone Symposia, and published in Dialogue. At least until the 1980s, Hugh was the one who stood in the way of such radically revisionist accounts of the Latter-day Saint past, even though he was not directly involved in writing accounts of the Restoration. He concerned himself from time to time with few troublesome complaints. Where the Latter-day Saints involved in the fledgling profession of Mormon history were anxious to secure a place in the history of the American West for the Latter-day Saints, Nibley's essays always stood as a witness to the truth of the Restoration, and hence he was in that sense a martyr, and also made him a defender of the faith or apologist. He always avoided the Mormon History Association. He was not a joiner but a loner. His understanding of the faith of the saints went far beyond the narrow confines of our pioneer past and the story of the Great Basin. He clearly did not fit within the new profession of Mormon history, though he had high regard for learning and serious scholarship. He refused to play the games academics typically play. He was contemptuous of titles, rank, reputation, all worldly adornments hardly worthy of a saint. He avoided scholarly meetings where the bulk of what takes place is socializing and networking. Instead, he gave hundreds of talks to groups of ordinary Latter-day Saints without ever talking down to his audience. He was not a snob. Some may have thought it was not appropriate for him to publish in the Old Improvement Era or the Ensign, or to have given talks on the radio or in stake centers. However, he saw these as opportunities for setting out some new challenging ideas for the saints and for opening a window on worlds they may never have encountered. Giving a talk was his way of having a conversation. When someone with a scholarly reputation visited BYU, Hugh sought him out and engaged him in conversation. I witnessed a number of these remarkable exchanges, one of which involved David Reisman, 1909-2002, the Harvard professor whose book, The Lonely Crowd, was by far the most read essay in sociology at the time. Reisman told Hugh, that to be for Mormonism the equivalent of St. Augustine for Latin Christianity. Then and there, conversations I witnessed with William Barrett, 1915-1992, whose book entitled Irrational Man, a study in existentialist philosophy, was then very popular, and Jacob Neusner, 1932-2016, the most widely published Jewish scholar. He was not interested in conversations with Protestant preachers over the question of faith and works, or with American historians bent on seeing Joseph Smith in the most narrow possible light. Since Hugh was an inveterate reviser of manuscripts, he needed a deadline. The necessity of having a manuscript ready for 30 consecutive weeks to be read on the radio within the prescribed time limits eventually yielded The World and the Prophets, one of his most impressive books. At the requirement that he produce a manuscript ready to be published each month, when he was generating those series that appeared in the Improvement Era, forced him to control his otherwise powerful urge to revise, refine, adjust, embellish, or extend. Without a deadline or a demanding editor of an academic journal, he had difficulty finishing a project. Without Hugh's far-reaching scholarship, there would be no foundation for ancient research and Mormon studies or Maxwell Institute, and therefore no defense of the faith and the saints. It was his work with which others could begin farms. And it was because of his profound and lasting influence on hundreds of scholars that the Farms Review has been possible. I have had the experience of thinking that I found a new way of looking at some passage in the Book of Mormon, only to find that what I thought I had discovered had already been almost casually mentioned by Hugh in some writing long before. Others have had exactly that experience in their own scholarly endeavors. He was not stuck on what he had previously written or said. If one could demonstrate, really show, and not merely assert a flaw in something he'd written, he would be grateful. This is a virtue not many academics have. He was, in fact, pleased to see others correcting and fleshing out his own work. Some have complained about all those footnotes. There were, they moan, far too many. Or they propagate the myth that his citations were phony. This nonsense has apparently come from someone who found a flaw in some citation. But this is not likely to be the case with those essays published by Farms in his collected works, where a sustained effort was made to check everything and, if necessary, to make needed corrections. I edited two of his essays. I checked every quotation and citation. I spent hundreds of hours tracking down his citations and making them consistent and getting them into the proper format. With much searching and a bit of ingenuity, I was able to locate every item. Of course, at times he read things into some of the literature he cited, where others might have read that literature differently. But this is exactly the case with all intellectual history. Early on in his career, when Fawn Brody, 1915-1981, published her attack on Joseph Smith, Nibley stepped forward to do a bit of counter-punching. What Brody wrote could easily be dealt with today's professional Latter-day Saint historians, who are now intimately familiar with the Joseph Smith papers. But in 1946, there were no such historians. Hugh, whose interests and training were in ancient history, took on the task of buying some time while others got up to speed. When the brethren requested that he deal with anti-Mormon literature, I heard him complain of having to do this. He resented having to take time from his other interests to deal with it. But there came a time after 1980 that Hugh no longer gave any attention to this dismal literature. He remained on the sidelines while Mark Hoffman was doing and generating mischief. He let others take over his previous role. Though he went through, I believe, a period during which he wondered if his work would have a lasting impact on Latter-day Saint scholarship, he was much reassured by the outpouring of scholarship published by Farms, and especially by what he found in the Farms Review. The last time I saw him, he complained that those at Farms were treating him as if he were had already passed away. The reason he gave was that he had not been sent a copy of the most recent number of the review. At that very moment, the doorbell rang and the postman delivered his copy. Hugh was delighted, and his wife Phyllis then had the task of reading over 400 pages aloud to him, something which she had become accustomed to doing during his declining years. I am constantly reminded that, like so many others, I owe much to Hugh Nibley. When he heard that Hugh had passed away, a friend from New Zealand, Elder Ian S. Ardern of the 70, currently president of the Pacific area, wrote to me and described Hugh's insights appropriately, I believe, as, quote, veil parting, end of quote. Hugh, he said, put his many gifts, his academic abilities, quote, to noble use, to give light to spiritual issues so that those that were comparatively blind could see a little further, end of quote. We can all be grateful for his valiant service in this regard. Whatever his quirks, his service to the kingdom was immense. As my Maori friends might say, a giant kauri has fallen. The nurture it once offered for God's creatures in the human forest has now been significantly reduced. But it's also true that when a giant kauri falls, its influence does not disappear. Its seeds still germinate, and its many seedlings continue to grow. Thus it is and should be with Hugh Nibley.